Welcome to Franchise Festival, where we go in-depth with noteworthy video game series from the last 40 years. For Season 5, we're working through BioWare's Mass Effect. Be sure to let us know what you think by emailing franchisefestival@gmail.com or reaching out through our Patreon page at patreon.com/franchisefestival. If you like the show, consider backing us on Patreon to get access to a bonus episode each month and get the chance to vote on future episode topics. As for us, we're your hosts, Chris,
Spencer,
and I'm Hamilton.
And today we're joined by a guest host. Could you introduce yourself and tell the listeners where they can find your work?
Hello, my name is Lily Bones. I'm so honored to be joining y'all on your podcast today.
The honor is ours.
I am an independent games journalist, and I operate off of the avocado.org and a personal Patreon. You can find me under the Game News Roundup series, where I sort of put all game press coverage in one place, and I have a little audience there. I do some other articles too, but that's the main thing that I'm doing is news coverage.
Yeah, I'm very partial to your mid-aughts meltdown, because it's an era of games that I'm like woefully unaware of.
I wish I did it more often.
You can tell like that it's a lot of work. What's your Patreon web address? Just so as a proud patron myself, I would strongly recommend everybody else patronize Lily as well.
Patreon.com/LilyTina.
Yeah, those game news roundups are amazing. They are at this point functionally 100% of the game news that I consume.
Incredibly comprehensive, yes. Ad-free, and editorial color commentary.
That's the best part, you know? You get a little bit of character in there, too.
It's irreplicable.
Exactly.
I'm here because I'm a Mass Effect fangirl and because Chris and I have been friends for many years. And I'm very excited to be here.
Welcome.
Yes, exactly. And we are happy to have you today as we discuss the middle act of Mass Effect 2. Including most of the remaining recruitments, as well as most of the loyalty missions. Listeners, we don't know how many loyalty missions we'll get through today. We have a block of time, and we are going to get through as many as we can cover in that time. So stick with us and find out which loyalty missions we do cover. Last time on Franchise Festival, the protagonist of Mass Effect 1, Shepard, was killed and remade by Cerberus, a human supremacist galactic faction that mostly operates outside of Council space, the region that we explored in Mass Effect 1, and we're now on a mission to uncover the connection between the Reapers, an alien existential threat to all life, and the Collectors, a race of these insectoid creatures that are absconding with the entire population of human colonies throughout the Terminus systems. Along the way, we recruited Miranda, Jacob, Jack, Morden, Garrus, Grunt, Zaid, and Kasumi. But we still have a few more people to get on board, so take us away to Ilium, Spencer.
Yep, so Ilium is an Asari colony that was settled as a trading hub between the Asari Republic and the Terminus systems. It kind of looks like Coruscant from Star Wars.
I thought so.
Yeah, I got kind of Blade Runner vibes from it. Like
I could see that.
What it's not called like New Future San Francisco. What the heck's it called in Blade Runner?
I think it's like New Los Angeles, I would think.
Maybe.
I think it's based on LA.
Well, anyway. When you dock, you get approached by, I guess they're like an administrator, and they talk about how the docking fees have been waived and everything, courtesy of Liara Tassoni.
Mm-hmm. Our old friend from Mass Effect 1.
Or more.
Or more, yeah.
Ilium is very much the counterpart of the Omega station that I assume you discussed in the previous episode.
Right.
Omega and Ilium are essentially both libertarian paradises. They're just like the high end and the low end version.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
You quickly learn to see the darker side of the Asari, who are sort of presented as one of the more enlightened races in the first game. I have so many thoughts on the Asari, especially as, like, as a trans woman. And the Asari are extremely complicated gender things that range from very simplistic juvenile sexualization to a whole lot of other stuff going on.
I was going to jump in, because I disagree with Hamilton a little bit. I feel like this game approaches complex issues a lot of times, but then it always just collapses it into very simple black or white outcomes and just abandons the whole premise of, like, dealing with a gray area situation.
Yeah, I wonder if they set themselves up for that with the need to, like, connect through the franchise, that, like, every situation needs to have kind of a binary conclusion so it can have a direct result in the next game.
The head writer of this series got replaced halfway through.
Really?
Yeah, that was Drew Karpyshyn, right?
Yes, Drew Karpyshyn, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the head writer of Mass Effect 1. He wrote the first several tie-in novels for the series, and then he was removed because EA reassigned him to the Old Republic MMO.
Oops!
What a use of resources that
is. Right? We learn that Liara is now working as an information broker, and that she would love to talk to us. So we go to her office, her assistant lets us in, and we see her on, like, a video call where she is threatening to flay someone alive with her mind. And she's got, like, the crazy eye going on, like, one eye is half closed and the other one's open real wide.
Giving him the stink eye.
Yeah, real sharp contrast to the, you know, the meek Liara that we remember from
The academic
Liara has changed a lot in the time Shepard's absence, and the loss of Shepard specifically has shaped her. This is a very constant recurring theme in BioWare games of innocent characters getting hardened by trauma in very specific ways.
Big kind of like Joss Whedon vibes, like similar themes.
Obviously has its own issues, but anyway.
Yeah, to say the least.
But after reuniting with Liara, we're gonna cover the Shadow Broker DLC I think next time, but she hints at something going on there. There's a dialogue tree where you can talk about how she's trying to find out who the identity of the Shadow Broker, right?
Liara was always going to have this quest line relating to the Shadow Broker because of the Shadow Broker's role in Shepard being sent to Cerberus. And it was going to be in the main game, and then they cut it because EA has launch deadlines that are very strict.
I did not know that. Thought the Shadow Broker was always planned as an add-on. I had no idea. That makes so much sense because it's so integral to the plot.
No, she was going to be a much bigger part of the game.
That makes sense.
So Liara gives us information. After reuniting with her, we can press her for information on the two people that we are here to recruit, Thane and Samara. Samara is an Asari Justicar who's here on the planet hunting after someone. It's interesting. I don't remember Justicars coming up at all in Mass Effect 1, and we don't run into ones outside of this, but they are...
Judge Dredd?
Like, officially sanctioned Asari vigilantes. She is here to, like, find someone and kill someone. The security on the station is, like, scared shitless of her.
She's also one of the oldest Asari you've met at this point.
She's the elf of the Mass Effect world.
Fun fact, Samara is also voiced by I forget her name, unfortunately, but the voice actress in question is the mother of Billie Eilish.
No.
Huh. Oh, really?
Yeah, aren't you glad I'm here? All these fun facts.
Darn right.
Yeah, so Liara points us toward, it's not called C6 around the Citadel, but a security officer named Dara, who's kind of keeping tabs on Samara in her investigation. And we also press her for info on an assassin named Thane. Thane is a Drell. Him and his son, who we meet in his loyalty mission, I think are the only two Drell we, like, ever encounter. They're very rare.
They definitely weren't in Mass Effect 1. I mean, they might have been referenced in, like, logs, but we never saw any of them.
I don't remember the details of it, but I get the impression they live on the Hanar homeworld. Yes. I don't think it started that way, and it seems like living on like an ocean planet gives them some kind of lung disease.
Their planet was ruined by industrialization and climate change. So the Hanar took them in as charity, but the Hanar's humid environment is destroying their bodies collectively. Yeah,
I forget where I read about that. It might have been in a log, or it might have been in like conversation with Thane, but he talks about, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself here, but he talks a little bit about how he was recruited by the Hanar to be an assassin. Yeah, and for listeners who don't remember, the Hanar are those weird, like, kind of amoeba-looking fellas.
Telepathic jellyfish.
Yeah, and they talk in a collective voice.
Mm-hmm.
So who are we going after first here, Spencer?
Well, we know Thane is on Ilium because he's pursuing a woman named Nassara. Mm-hmm. And yeah, right. We can talk. Liara points us toward a separate woman named Serena who can give us more info. So let's go after Thane first here.
Mm-hmm. Let's.
We go to the shipping department to meet Serena so she can give us a little bit of background here. Now, I didn't follow this that closely. Correct me if I'm wrong here. So Nassara is like an executive at some big corporation, and she's been doing shady stuff and has been having people killed to cover up what she was doing. Serena was like a whistleblower, right? And got fired for it. And then she passed the information on to Thane. And now Thane is going to kill Nassara.
That's my understanding.
Okay. Also, Nassara is a side quest giver in Mass Effect 1.
Oh, dang! Oh. I didn't... I skipped over a lot of the side quests in Mass Effect 1.
I might have done it. I don't remember.
Basically, the very quick gist is that she introduces herself to Shepard in Mass Effect 1 as a diplomat whose family is being targeted by some criminals.
Oh!
Her sister is a criminal underworld leader. And she lied to you and tricked you into killing her sister in order to, A, protect her reputation as a politician, and B, allow her to seize her assets for herself.
So we find Serena, and she comes up with a plan. The building is struck. There's like two towers.
Gandalf is there. Yeah.
It's okay.
So one of them is under construction, and the two are connected by these sky bridges. So the idea is to get dropped off in the basement of the tower that is under construction, climb to the top, and then cross over to the top of the occupied tower where Nassara is going to be located. As soon as we get dropped off, though, we're immediately attacked by mechs. So Nassara knows that Thane is after her, and she has hired the Eclipse Gang to basically guard the tower and stop him from getting in. But now you're trying to get in, so they are trying to stop you.
Exactly. Yeah, it's theoretically a three-way battle, but really it's just us versus Eclipse, and Thane is mysteriously in the background somewhere.
Yeah, we get some like radio chatter about, oh, we spotted him on the second floor. No, we spotted him on the ninth floor. We spotted him everywhere.
Right.
So we know he's a very sneaky guy.
So
we start fighting our way up the tower. We can find some like workers here that got kind of caught in the crossfire. We can rescue them. The climax comes when we reach the top and we have to actually cross the sky bridge. Now, I'm curious about what your experience was with this, because when I got to that point and started to cross it, there's a conversation you have with an NPC where they warn you about how dangerous the high winds are when you go to cross, and they're liable to blow you off. But then that wasn't represented mechanically at all for me. It was just a normal like corridor fight. Okay.
Yeah.
I cannot emphasize enough how rushed these games are.
Yeah, you can really kind of see it around the edges sometimes. It's incredible, like, especially playing it now, just how wildly further ahead this was than even things that came out like 5 years earlier, technically. But it's still like you can see the seams sometimes.
People are very nostalgic for these 2 year development cycles, but but they always had consequences.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks don't remember how janky games of the 90s and 2000s were.
I mean, we learned that through the Mega Man series. Just like,
good lord, yeah.
Like every 6 months, there's a new game.
As long as you do, like, 15-hour shifts, sleep under your desk, and don't care about the fact that fundamental parts of the game are broken, you can publish a game in 6 months.
Right?
So once we fight our way across the sky bridge and we get to Nassara's office, she sucks. She's just a real nasty person. And she's gotta go, which is just as well because
her mental breakdown right before she dies.
Yeah, but it's just as well because Thane drops down from a vent, murders her and her guards, and then turns to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn about Thane Krios.
Yeah.
He wears this cool leather jacket with a humongous collar on it.
He's very Neo.
Well, we talked about Morden Solus's like huge collar last time, and like Garrus's mm-hmm. also has a huge collar.
Huh.
And like the more I noticed it, like every character in this has a humongous collar.
Yeah, that's weird.
If I were to offer a very quick theory, my theory is that the reason there's so many like sort of big pieces of armor and collars in this game is that they're trying to find a way to visually evolve the series within their very limited production time frame.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all about silhouettes.
Mm-hmm.
It was also thinking about it, the style at the time was to have an oversized piece of clothing in popular games. So like World of Warcraft has the iconic humongous shoulder pads, Kingdom Hearts, yep. Sora has humongous clown shoes.
And zippers everywhere. Yeah.
Yep. Mass Effect's got big collars, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 2000s thing. Yeah.
Is this, so we're introduced to Thane. We already went over the Drell, his clothes. He's kind of, he's dispassionate, but he's got a religious thing going on. We touched on the religious intersection between the Drell and the Hanar, but mm-hmm. he says like, what is it? He says he's needs to say a prayer over her after he kills her. And we have a little conversation where he's like, it's a prayer for the wicked. And he goes, oh, something, something. And he goes, no, it wasn't for her. It was for me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So cool, there's like a penitent aspect of it.
Thane started as a purely mercenary assassin and then converted to the old Drell religions later in life.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a guy who killed for money until he fell in love, and then his criminal ties cost him his wife. And this is a lot to drop all at once. I'm sorry.
It's a good idea because we probably won't. We won't get into enough of his background.
Mm-hmm. Well, his background comes up in his loyalty mission.
Yeah, that's true. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
After he converted, now all of his assassinations are very morally, spiritually motivated. There.
He became Dexter from TV's Dexter.
Dexter was a great show that had exactly four seasons and not a single
other one.
Yep. It just faded. It's like The Simpsons. It faded elegantly into the background after into the distance after nine good seasons.
No comment.
No comment.
Yep. So this is where we learn that Thane is dying. He's got space tuberculosis. So this is going to be yep. his last. Yep. This is his last job. But you know, because he's trying to sort of repent for his wicked life, he thinks that this is a great opportunity to go on this like suicide mission to save human colonists.
Yeah. Balance the well, scales.
The whole galaxy, really. I guess it's. Mm-hmm. We know that the threat of this is goes beyond the scope of just humans being abducted, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
What about Samara? Should we move along to Samara, Spencer?
Yeah, let's. So now that we've got Thane, we can go talk to Officer Dara in the transportation hub, who sends us to follow Samara to the Ilium's commercial spaceport.
Mm-hmm.
We already went over her role as a Justicar.
Yeah.
When we first get there, there's a crime scene that we need permission to get into. There was a murder, right? And there's a Volus merchant named Pitney Four who is the lead suspect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. He's trying to get out of the spaceport because the Justicar's there. He's scared that she's going to start killing people and wants to leave, but they won't let him leave because he's a suspect, obviously.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. And like all Volus is like a weird little round guy with a raspy voice.
Mm-hmm.
So we can get permission to go check out the crime scene. We can snoop around.
Mm-hmm.
At some point here. So Anaya is different than Anaya's not Dara. I'm getting the characters mixed up.
Yeah, Dara's in the hub and directs us here. Anaya is the Asari detective who is at the like little police station that we find here by the shipping yard.
Got it. So she laments that her boss kind of wants her to detain Samara because they don't like the sort of civil unrest that her presence is causing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is how we kind of get permission to go to the crime scene. We insert ourselves into this and be like, hey, we need to go in there. We're looking for someone. We're looking for Samara, actually. We can, like, help her out and we can get her out of your hair. We'll save you from the situation. So she agrees. You go through. And you find Samara fighting and killing a bunch of Eclipse mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
But after we go in and we talk to Samara, Anaya shows up anyway and basically says, you know what? My boss kind of didn't give me a choice. I have to detain her. And we are revealed that the Justicar Code requires that she will comply with local laws and regulations for exactly one day. After that point, she is walking out on her own accord, even if she has to kill every cop in the place to do so.
Yeah, real Terminator 1 energy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Narratively, it's a ticking clock element, but there's not actually a time limit that you have to adhere to. So you've got that 24 hours to try to find the name of the ship that Samara is trying to find before she kills all the cops and walks out of there.
This ticking clock element is one of several that happen in the game that suggest that there's a ticking clock narratively, but mechanically there's not. And then that gets reversed in kind of an awkward way very late in the game.
There will eventually be a timer.
Yes.
But not when you expect it.
Nope.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we do a little bit of snooping around here, and we kind of find that Pitney 4 is involved with these mercs in his partner's death. So we go back and interrogate him, and we get him to give us his key card to a local Eclipse base.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go sneak into the base, fight our way to whoever can tell us the name of this, because we find out that they were hired to smuggle... we don't know that it's... Do we know it's an Ardat Yakshi at this point, or is it still mysterious what the...
Yeah, we don't know that it's an Ardat Yakshi yet.
We know it's a dangerous person, I think, that she's pursuing, and the dangerous person hired the Eclipse mercenaries to get smuggled off-world. Mm-hmm. So that's why we need to find this ship. Go through pretty straightforward. Like, most of this game, you're just fighting mercenaries, and it all plays out very similarly. Chest-high walls, hide behind it, pop up, use your power, shoot your gun, shields go away, dip back behind cover, rinse, repeat, forever. Yeah,
it plays well in the moment, but it's really not... not interesting to talk about.
Yeah. I got a little bit of mixed messages with what the... Because they're called the Eclipse Sisters, right? I thought they were... They're presented at first, I thought, like an all-female, like, Asari gang. But then you run into not that.
I'd imagine it's like the Blue Suns, where they're, like, predominantly Batarian, but there are also others. Maybe the Eclipse is predominantly Asari, but there are also others.
Like, sympathizers that, like, believe in their cause.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Led, but at a certain point, you simply have to have a diverse recruitment policy.
Yeah, crimes aren't going to commit themselves.
Right?
So we shoot our way through the Eclipse base until we get toward sort of the leader. Before we go into the leader's room, though, we get kind of a funny scene. We find a Volus named Niftu Kahl, who is high out of his mind on some biotic enhancing drug.
Yes.
And he thinks he calls himself a god, and he like threatens you and walks around like he's Goku. just
and either you encourage him to charge in and get himself killed, or you gently usher him away.
Yeah, what did everybody do here?
I was nice. I gently shoot him away.
Yeah, I like did the karate chop to knock him out. I really wanted to send him into that room, but I didn't do it.
I did, yeah.
Well, good news, everybody, I sent him into the room. So it's pretty funny. It's pretty funny. He goes in there and he just like he kind of dunks on who's this person that we're going to in here. I didn't take her name down. She's just the local leader of the Eclipse. He gives her a really hard time, and he's like you know, acting very arrogant, and like throws a little kind of mental blast at her or something. And she just shoos it away. And then she slams him against a wall and kills him.
Yeah. No, his death is very funny. But if you spare him, he will show up again later.
Oh. Okay.
I will also note that in the Mass Effect 3 multiplayer mode, you can play as a Volus biotic god. And that was my main.
It still kind of breaks my heart that I never played any Mass Effect 3 multiplayer, because it's the one major part they stripped out of the legendary one.
It was so fun.
Yep. So we move on into there. We encounter the Eclipse Leader. The room's full of poison crates and explosives. There's not a ton to talk about with this fight other than that, though. At least I don't think. At this point, from this point forward, my squad was powerful enough that outside of, like, specific set piece boss fights, these all sort of just went so quickly that it was hard to discern much, like, unique about them.
Yeah, I whipped out the collector beam and just pointed it at her, and she died in less than 3 seconds. There basically wasn't a fight.
Yeah, as going, like, full bonus damage biotic, like, casting warp or singularity once will half kill a boss, and it's right on, like, a 3 second cooldown, so.
Yep.
The old school Mass Effect fandom often said that the real way to play the games was insane difficulty.
So with the Eclipse Leader dead, we take her data pad and we find the name of the ship that Samara is looking for. So we can take that back to the spaceport, tell Samara, and then we can leave. It's interesting. The logistics of the Justicar Oath are interesting because she talks about different aspects of the Oath leading up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it seems very serious. But when she joins you, you can ask, oh, is there going to be a problem? Like, what happens if the orders I give you conflict with the Oath? And she just goes, oh, no, there's an oath called the Oath of Subsummation. So when I swore myself to you, that just overwrites the Justicar code. Don't worry about it.
Mm.
What a convenient code.
I'm like, oh, it's that easy? It's a binding, borderline religious commitment, unless you decide you want to commit to a different thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Although I like that if she was forced to do anything against the code while she was under Shepard, then after she stopped being under Shepard, the code would require her to kill Shepard.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some Ilium side stuff here in the notes, but I think we'll cut this for time, just because there's so much other main content going on.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to point out the one thing that gave me a laugh-out-loud chuckle here, and a sorrowful chuckle at that, were the radio ads for Indenture Tech. We've got these ads saying, and I quote, "You've been a slave to your employees for too long. Shouldn't it be the other way around?" Which feels like it could go on, like, the billboard of virtually any major American corporation in the year 2025.
Yeah, and there is also a side quest that directly engages with the legalized slavery on Ilium.
I wanted to bring that side quest up because that one actually really ticked me off.
Oh, what happens in it?
Basically, you run into a situation where there's like a quarry and slave, and there's this corporation that wants to buy her because she's like an expert in like the very specific field of like AI programming that they need. But they don't want to deal with the like publicity hit that comes from buying a slave.
Mm-hmm.
And they have no idea what to do. So you as Shepard, the most intelligent and noble person in the galaxy, goes up to them and just goes, hey, what if you just buy the slave and then free them and then garnish their wages to pay yourself back? And they're like, oh, my God, you've cracked the code. No one's ever thought of that.
Bleak.
Very bleak.
Renegade points gained.
Damn.
Okay, so our next mission is recruiting Tally Zora.
Yep.
Yes, I am recruiting you. That's the name of my cat.
Oh my goodness, I never made that connection.
But yes, you recruit Tally, returning companion from the first game.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get to the proper synopsis of Heistrom in a second, but yeah, there's a part on Heistrom where some accidental destruction occurs and your path is blocked by a wall that is barely higher than the chest-high walls you take cover behind.
It's like how Shepard gets winded after, like, a split second of dashing, you know?
Right.
So, yes, Heistrom is a planet that is very close to its nearest star, to its nearest sun. It is a planet that is occupied by the Quarians and by their enemies, the Geth.
And the purpose of the facilities on Heistrum is that they are studying the fact that this star is degrading far more rapidly than is natural. Which creates a big environmental hazard in the mission, where if you step out of shadowed spots on the map, the sun burns through your shields and health very rapidly.
I think that's really cool.
The Quarians are studying this star's degradation, and that setup is a big mystery, and I'll get back to that in a second. But the important thing for you is that Tally is on the planet investigating the same issue, and now her squadron has been killed by local Geth, and she is pinned down, and you are coming in to rescue her from the Geth. You have very strong visual design of the environments in this mission, using the Quarian and Geth aesthetics that have been established so far.
Mm-hmm. Those are cool, and the mechanical element of like the sunlight is neat too, because they very specifically have to make sure that there's very high contrast between the lit areas and the shadow areas, so you know where the safe places are for you to stand.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of like pops a little bit in a way that other outdoor environments in this game don't.
Mm-hmm.
So you progress through the mission. Again, all the other Quarians on the planet are already dead. You have the bit that I already mentioned, where you have to blow up some rubble that is so easy to maneuver around already.
And that's like half the mission. Like half the time you spend here on Heistrum is collecting the little charges to blow up a wall that by all rights you should be able to step over.
Yeah, and then after you blow through that, you get to the final area, which is where you meet the other surviving Quarian character, Kahl Rieger.
Yeah, he's a Marine.
Yes, Kahl Rieger is your straight-laced soldier type. He's the buffest Quarian you ever meet in these games.
Mm-hmm.
He's voiced by Adam Baldwin, who was one of the leaders of the Gamergate movement.
Oh no, I had no idea. What a bummer.
He was cast in the game because BioWare were Firefly fans. His character is killed off screen in Mass Effect 3, so you don't have to suffer from his presence too much. It's a very unpleasant random stain.
Oh no. I just looked up Adam Baldwin. He endorsed Ted Cruz for president.
That's so sad.
Oh,
I don't think even Ted Cruz endorsed Ted Cruz for president.
Anyway, yeah, Kahl Rieger's not a fun character. You can accidentally kill him if you want, whatever.
Right.
Get him killed because he's helping you with the boss fight. Yeah, which is a good boss fight, yes. The Geth Colossus, very clever design where it has a self-healing mechanism. Yeah, something that was introduced in the first game, but that was it just worked completely differently there because you just missiled it with your Mako.
Yeah, I was thinking, I was like, why is this Colossus so much more interesting and problematic than the ones in the first game? And it's because you always fought them with your Mako.
I could talk so much just about the Mako if I wanted to. I'm a Mako fan, to be clear.
I go so back and forth. I know every time we have a guest on the Mass Effect season, we kind of relitigate the Mako because it's such an interesting, awkward part of the series. And like, I think broadly, by and large, what was it, Spencer, you and I mostly liked the Mako, and Hamilton, you disliked it.
I mostly disliked it, yes.
Yeah, I think both perspectives are pretty reasonable, I gotta say.
Mm-hmm.
And the Legendary Edition does solve the biggest problems the Mako had.
It's so much better now, yeah.
But moving on.
Right.
That's the last of the combat part of the mission. So, this is one of the biggest behind-the-scenes story for this whole trilogy.
Oh, yeah, tell me.
As we mentioned earlier, the star that Heistrum orbits is degrading faster than it should, and that's causing the dangerous sunlight radiation in the planet.
Mm-hmm.
This was written by Drew Karpyshyn, and was... He was planning to set this up as one of the main plot lines of Mass Effect 3. Supposed to be one of the main plot lines of Mass Effect 3 was that stars were dying too fast, and then you were investigating the consequences and the causes of this, and it was going to tie back into the Reaper's origins and relate to some like hard sci-fi stuff that I'm not smart enough to explain.
So does that ever come up again in the games as published?
when Karpshin moved off the projects, this plotline was completely dropped because he was the only one that cared about it.
Bummer.
Moving on. Yeah, Tali is, you know, very mad that all her friends died on this mission. That doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, Tali's rage is even more justified by the behind-the-scenes angling of the game.
Yeah, she's just very aggravated, so she sends the data back to the admirals, and she says, yeah, fine, Shepard, I'll join your mission. I need to be away from my own people for a while.
Yeah.
And she doesn't like the fact that you're working with Cerberus, because they did so much stupid shit in the first game.
Yeah, and she's kind of mean to Jacob, but I like that Jacob takes it in stride. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot to complain about with Jacob, but he does have a touch of grace here for Tali being reasonably angry with Cerberus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we move along to the loyalty missions, I wanted to give a couple of general character updates here, just checking in with some folks on the Normandy. So first, because we haven't highlighted Joker too much, the pilot of the Normandy in our Mass Effect 2 coverage, but he's got his own kind of little story going on with Edie, the ship's AI, mm-hmm. where they're kind of getting on each other's nerves. It's like an odd couple relationship where he's bickering with her in the cockpit and he keeps smearing her cameras with grease. And he says, what is it? Like, it's like she's living in a flashback or something. And then also wanted to check in with Dr. Chakwas, our favorite person over in the medical bay, because as a follow-up to last episode where we got her the brandy, now we can share the brandy with her and get totally plastered. She starts recounting like misadventures with Caden, and she brings up Jenkins from Mass Effect 1.
Mm-hmm.
Rest in peace, Leroy Jenkins.
Mm-hmm.
She gives us a little bit of background on why she stuck with the Normandy, even though she was Alliance, the government organization on the Citadel. She stuck with the Normandy to look after Joker when he moved over here to be the pilot of the Normandy. Even though she doesn't have any affection for Cerberus, she feels like Joker needs somebody to help him out and be on his side.
Good beat.
And so then we can toast to my options were the Alliance, Joker, the Fallen, or Friends. So I picked Friends.
I think I picked Friends as well.
I think I picked the Fallen. I only had two options. I only had the Alliance or the Fallen.
It depends on how the conversation goes, because things kept getting added to it as she talked.
Ah.
Yeah, and so then she passes out on a medical bed and we can wander around the Normandy with shaky vision.
Yeah, if you played GTA and got drunk in that, or Red Dead.
Right.
Drunk game mechanics have come a long way since this. I love that mission in Red Dead 2 where you go drinking with Lenny, and then everyone looks like Lenny at a certain point.
Alright, so next up is the loyalty missions, and for folks who aren't familiar with the concept of this, who haven't played the game, once you recruit a character and talk to them often enough, you're given the opportunity to go on a mission that is relevant to their personal story, and in so doing, A, you get a cool story. This is really like the meat of the game here, is the loyalty missions, but B, it unlocks an extra ability for the character, and impacts the end of the game. So, ideally, you do every loyalty mission, but, you know, varies from player to player.
Mm-hmm. Keeping your companions' loyalty flags active is very essential to keeping them alive.
Keeping their heart beating.
Exactly.
It increases their chances of survival by, like, a fucking, like, 10-to-1 ratio or something. It's crazy.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Because we haven't talked about this on this show, but I think every main character in this game can die.
Correct. Even Shepard.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I truly believe that loyalty missions are, look, these are flawed games. I think loyalty missions are one of the biggest innovations of this generation, game design-wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would really go on to influence a lot in the next generation, eh?
Yeah, you want this degree of not only encouraging depth between the player and their characters, the depth of the relationship between the player and the characters, enabling that on a mechanical level, but also increasing the dynamic play of the game.
So, Hamilton, why don't you tell us about Garrus's loyalty mission?
So, Garrus, everyone's favorite Turian, or maybe not, I don't know. In the first game, he was, he kind of wanted things done his own way, kind of justice done, kind of like...
Yeah.
I don't really want consequences for my actions, I just want to kill people and make things better, and Shepard was just like, that's probably not the best.
Garrus, Dirty Harry Vicarian, yeah.
Yeah.
It's really carried by the charisma of the voice actor.
It's true, yeah. Garrus presents really well in these games, even if, you know, a little cringeworthy.
Garrus as a character is great, but there's, like, a weird thing that happens in this mission where I felt like they tried to, like, retroactively change him from Mass Effect 1. Because, like, throughout this whole mission, there's, like, multiple conversations where you can be like, Garrus, this isn't like you. It's not...
Right.
It isn't like you to try to go circumvent authority and just take matters into your own hands like
to
this.
Be a rogue cop.
That was like his whole thing, the whole game. What do you mean this isn't?
Right.
Yeah. You were supposed to be able to guide him away from that.
Well, I guess I let him lean into it. Oops.
The thing is, like, even if you do, like, convince him by the books, I tried really hard in the first game. Like, I still remember him leaning in. He's just like... Yeah, I guess you're right. But he doesn't, like, change his thought process, really. He's just like, Garrus, you shouldn't be a rogue cop. And he's like, yeah, I guess I shouldn't. And then the very next mission you have him, you're just like, Garrus, you are a rogue cop again. And he's like, yeah. Garrus, you shouldn't do that. And he's like, yeah.
Yeah, but I watched a whole bunch of seasons of 24, and I love that Jack Bauer. Yeah.
So, as we remember, we covered in the in a previous cast... previous episode, like, he was a leader of a band of kind of not so much mercenaries, I would say, like, rogue
his
cop
men.
Ideas like him.
Yeah,
people kind of followed him,
the Chris Redfield of the game, if you will.
Exactly. And sadly they all died. However, they died due to betrayal,
right,
of someone that Garrus trusted quite a lot, actually.
Sidonis.
So now it's like his life mission, like, I need to get revenge on him before I can, like, really move on. Yet again,
right.
The thing with loyalty missions is that you don't have to do it, but there's really no good reason not to. Because one, as we said, they get their extra special ability. And
yeah,
their ability might be abilities that you can also get.
I only discovered that literally today while playing. When you go to the research terminal, anybody who's become loyal,
yep,
you can spend points or spend a currency to get their loyalty power, which is a neat bonus effect that I wasn't aware of.
I kind of super like it. I actually took Samara's because hers is just like a parasite ability. So you deal damage and then you get their health.
Yeah.
But in any case, so... If we decide to do loyalty mission, we're just like, okay, we're going to help you hunt down Sidonis and, like, avenge your comrades. But to do so, we need to start off at the Citadel to meet a specialist named Fade. And he was seen with Sidonis recently, so maybe we'll get some ideas.
Right.
Back at the Citadel in the Neon Markets, C-Sec tells us that Fade is a forger who works with the Blue Suns.
We're on the Citadel, so it's time for the Blue Suns.
Pretty much. They make a comeback. And they work outside a marketplace warehouse, so that's going to be our next lead. At the warehouse proper, we confront a Volus criminal who gives us a lead on the Fade. Sorry, I'm going to step that over because I said the Fade, even though that's kind of cool.
We got a little Dragon Age in here.
I'm about to say, like, I made him a little bit cooler sounding than he actually is.
I kind of want to leave that in. Let's leave that in. Let's leave that as a little, that's a little franchise festival Easter egg for BioWare's other IP.
I kind of like it.
So who is Fade? We find out who Fade is.
Yeah. So he's a Harkin.
Yep.
A disgraced ex-CSEC officer who gave us a lead on Garrus in the first game.
Yeah, pretty cool. He's the guy who we met in the bar.
Sadly, now he has to be hunted down by us. We track him to another warehouse, and we chase him through hordes of Blue Sun goons and mechs. Some will ambush us out of shipping containers.
Yeah, I think this is cool. Like, a shipping container will fall from the ceiling and open up, and some mechs will, like, activate and walk out. I did want to point out that this whole sequence feels like a Time Crisis level.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I should be pressing a pedal to, like, jump out of cover and shoot these guys.
I think it's kind of cool, too, because it's, like, made for Garrus, who is primarily a sniper.
Yeah, oh, good point. Shoot, yeah.
Like, our part is to be able to hide under things and, like, get out of cover and, like, shoot. At least in my opinion, I thought that was kind of cool.
No, that's really thematically consonant with, like a shooting gallery for the, you know, ex-cop vigilante.
Our showdown involves two giant mechs at the end.
Yeah, those are the things that we originally fought with the Quarians back on, I want to say, Freedom's Progress at the beginning of the game, but now there's two of them.
Yeah. Though by this point, we've also powered up too, so...
Right.
We'll probably do a great deal of damage to them once we defeat them. Garrus eventually catches Harkin, beats him up, naturally, and has him set up a meeting with Sidonis. So, hopefully we can get his revenge underway. Also, I kind of like the fact that Harkin got beat up.
I stopped him from shooting him in the legs, but he still walks up and headbutts him, even if he stopped
him.
Yeah,
I stopped him from shooting him in the legs, too, yeah.
Garrus had history with me, and I was just like, have your way, just don't kill him.
Yeah, maybe they have sci-fi medicine.
Yeah, throw some metagel on that bad boy.
Metagel, there we go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you meet up with Sidonis eventually. Garrus and Shepard talk to Sidonis while he sets up and snipes him. I think it gives you dialogue options, or like, you can, I think you can actually spare Sidonis, because I think in most of these missions, correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah,
you can go, like, super Paragon and just be like... Because a lot of missions involve a lot of revenge, which, I mean, is, like, fair, whatever. And you have the option of, I guess, being the bigger person? Look, I let everyone get their revenge all the time. But with Garrus, I'm just like, screw Sidonis, I don't even know this guy.
Garrus's mission requires extra inputs from you to get the Paragon ending. You have to do multiple Paragon interrupts in a row to keep Sidonis safe from Garrus's bullet. And then persuade Garrus on top of that. So it's a lot of extra effort. I go to every single time.
Yeah, I screwed this up because I intended to let Garrus snipe the guy. And then I accidentally warned the guy.
Oh no.
Yeah, I accidentally, like, I was trying to select the, like, the dialogue option for, like, stay silent. And let Garrus take him out. But inadvertently, Shepard was like, hey, some guy named Garrus is trying to shoot you. And then Sidonis, like, freaks out and starts to run off. And Garrus is going to take the shot. And you can interrupt again. But then I was like, nah, that's enough. And so Garrus takes the shot.
It's not just about having sympathy for Sidonis as a person. You don't have to have that. Like, you know, you can also try to worry about just how far over the edge Garrus is going.
I do like that if you spare Sidonis, he, like, confesses to his crimes and ends up going to jail. Like, he's been torn up about it for the same amount of time, which is a cool character beat that I wish we got otherwise.
Oh, that's cool. I had no idea. I just let him die.
Yeah. I'm the opposite of Hamilton. I'm the non-story guy. So there's a troubling number of times where I miss key details.
You're just like, what's the quickest way to get through this? Garrus, just take the shot!
When Mass Effect 1 first came out, there was a contingent of the audience who weren't able to save Rex because they hadn't engaged with the persuade mechanic at all. Are you one of those people?
So I was not. I've always saved Garrus. I mean, I've always saved Rex. I was a different player back when this came out. I hadn't played as many story-heavy games, and so I was a lot more into the story back then. And as time went on, this is an interesting conversation for another time, perhaps. But, you know, it's one of those things where you encounter stories enough times. And if you're really into story-heavy games early on, I think you sometimes gravitate towards mechanics heavy stuff later on, just because you've played so many story heavy games, and so it's harder to, like, surprise you or that sort of thing. And so that's unfortunate, for better or worse, the route that I'm on. So you know, back around 2010, I was much more like, I gotta see every dialogue option. And now I'm a lot more like, just give me the cliff notes, buddy.
I feel like I've always been a story person. Although, I guess to that effect, there are a lot of games I played in the past on the Sega and SNES and etc. where it's like there really wasn't a whole lot of story to happen. Or like,
I wonder if you moved in the opposite direction.
I think I did. Because, like, even the RPGs that I played, like, I liked the game mechanics. But I think either I was too young to, or didn't really understand the story beats. I couldn't really appreciate it.
Right.
So I more just kind of played the games because I could press buttons and it was fun. But as I grew older, I grew more immersed in the world of every game.
Yeah.
So now it's tough to kind of play games if they're just too button mashing, unless that's the point of it.
Sure, sure, sure.
But I do prefer to have a story that kind of brings me in so I could feel more involved in the world.
I would say I'm pretty balanced between story and mechanics. They're both very important.
Yeah.
A game won't be my favorite game if it doesn't also have a really good story. Like, yeah, it has same. To. It won't get yeah, that same. High without good mechanics, but the story is what will put it over the top. Story and themes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I wonder if I'm shifting on this again recently is the funny thing, because most of the games that I've played that I've liked the most this year are story forward, which is very weird for me for the last, like, decade. Mm-hmm. But maybe it's starting to change again, you know? You go through different phases in life.
Sure. Right? Now, I would argue that Claire Obscure is a pretty mechanics-forward game as well.
I think it's really nicely balanced.
I haven't played Death Stranding 2 yet to comment on it, but...
It's pretty balanced, too. Yeah. And so we move on to Jack's loyalty mission.
Hi, I'm taking lead on this one.
Do it.
We don't have enough time, so I'm not going to dwell on this, but I want to say the reason I asked to take lead on this is because, look, as an adult, I can recognize Jack's a pretty tropey character, obviously, but...
Sure.
Jack, when this game originally released and has continued to in the years since, Jack has always represented a lot and meant a lot to me personally.
Oh, cool.
As a woman of traumatic background, I will leave it at that.
Sure.
This story, specifically a queer woman of traumatic background. Yeah, this...
Yeah.
There's a more, you know, there's a much more sophisticated version of the kind of story this game is telling, and games after it would get a lot farther in this respect, like Baldur's Gate, for example.
Yeah?
Jack is just a character who really means a lot to me. She's really important. I can understand why she can be an off-putting character.
Yeah, truth be told, I'm happy to hear this because we were a little down on Jack in the previous episode with her recruitment because she's so, like, abrasive. And so it's good to have an alternative perspective on the character.
Mm-hmm. So Jack's story is that she was... from a very young age, imprisoned and held in a remote Cerberus testing facility. The reason she is such a hyperbiotic today is because she was experimented on and provoked into expanding her biotic powers as far as they possibly could go for a human.
Right, very Eleven from Stranger Things in some ways.
God, thank God Mass Effect was before Stranger Things.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah.
Yeah, Jack... Also, yeah, important thing to understand. Jack's a very young person. Jack is in her early 20s in Mass Effect 2. She's basically a big kid, and she acts like it. Yeah, she has this background of this, horrific torture and experimentation and imprisonment, and she, to sort of resolve her lingering anger over this childhood, she wants to find the base where she was raised and blow it up.
Good.
During your exploration of the Cerberus facility on Pragya, you start to learn that a lot of the things that Jack remembered about this experience are not the same as the reality of the situation. This is a very well-documented thing that PTSD will warp your memory.
Yeah, it makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Generally, like, yeah, you're a child, you're not going to pay attention to all of the necessary information. It's not always going to be available to you. Basically she's just constantly being surprised by things she didn't know when she was a kid, when this was actually happening to her. She didn't know how big the facility was, how many other kids were there. She didn't know that they were actually doing it without Cerberus leadership's knowledge. Cerberus is terrible.
Yes.
The fact that in this one specific case, this wasn't on their orders does not absolve them of anything. I want to be very clear about that.
Right, exactly, yeah. They can still be evil without being responsible for this specific evil.
Yeah, the more she learns, the more, like, shocking information she learns about what happened at the facility, she's at first in a great deal of denial about it, but is ultimately able to sort of go through the process of
of grief and reaches a level of acceptance towards what happened to her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she hates all the other kids originally, but she discovers as it goes on that her perspective was limited.
Yeah, she remembers it as the researchers hated her and the kids hated her and everyone went out of their way to persecute her. And then she finds out that actually the kids were the ones that were being treated worse than her because she had the most biotic potential. They had to keep her alive. So the kids got the extreme versions of the test so that they knew where to hold back to make sure they didn't kill her.
Mm.
She did not realize that. Yeah, it's a nice little metaphor for, oh, everyone has trauma to an extent, you know?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You can't be too self-absorbed in how you engage with your own issues.
Yeah, I like the fact that they don't, like, make light of, like, literally anyone suffering. It's like, yes, technically the other kids didn't go as much as she did. But even though she still suffered, like, everyone is still kind of the losing end of this. So it's like, you also can't play off what you've gone through.
Right.
Yeah, it's just allowing you to interrogate yourself and engage with your own feelings in a more complicated way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like a prompt, eh?
Also, another major symptom of PTSD is hyper-independence. Jack, you know, pushes everyone away from her. She says she's the only person she ever needs. She comes to learn that she was not the one who freed herself. It was the other children who freed her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense because it would have been a lot harder for her to free herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stands to reason, eh?
Yeah, it's perfectly rational, but we are not perfectly rational people. Anyway.
Exactly, yeah.
And, yeah, of course, there's combat encounters along the way. You fight some Blood Pack mercenaries.
It wouldn't be a Mass Effect 2 loyalty mission if there weren't mercenaries somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a little question. Why are there still living people here in these ruins, right?
Sure.
So you get to the center of the facility where you meet Aresh. Aresh is another surviving test subject of the Cerberus facility. Aresh is rationalizing his own trauma by convincing himself that it had purpose and value.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people want to believe that things have happened for a reason because that's comforting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, he is taking this to the extent that he thinks he should start to restart the experiments.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of traumatized people revisiting that trauma on others is, you know, such a resonant theme, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Totally, yeah. And the game also very clearly underlines he does not have the resources to achieve this.
Yes.
He's just a sad, lonely man. He does not have the power to mass kidnap and torture children in any capacity.
Right.
Because clearly, I mean, you can see the base. It's in ruins.
It looks a lot like the facility in Portal at the start of Portal 2.
Mm-hmm.
His plan is already kind of falling apart by the time you even come on the scene, because when you show up, like, there's dialogue you can find. The mercenary crew that he hired to come, like, help salvage this place are just about ready to turn on him because there's not a lot of salvage and he can't pay them.
Right.
Yeah, he is in no way a real threat, but nonetheless, it's such an obviously upsetting premise of restarting the experiments that it upsets Jack. She threatens to kill him, thus positioning Shepard to once again be the moral arbiter of everyone else's lives. Shepard can proceed to either persuade Jack to spare Aresh or encourage her to kill him. The charm prompt that you use to persuade her argues what we've already said, that Aresh isn't it's not actually possible for him to restart the experiments, but that, more relevantly to her, that killing him would be letting her trauma keep controlling her.
Mm-hmm.
I would call this the canonical choice for her character growth.
Of course, yeah. The alternative is pretty grim.
Mm-hmm.
She tells him to leave, and the last thing you do is just do a little point-and-click adventure segment where you click on different spots in her cell, and she reminisces about her childhood. And that's a really nice bit.
I feel like that's a rare grace note in some of these. Like, so many of the loyalty missions turn into just, like, here's a shooting gallery to resolve your personal issues. And having kind of a quiet moment to reflect is really nice.
You really feel these games chafing against the confines of the shooter genre.
Yes.
Yeah, these are often the highlights of these games, for sure, is... Yeah, games, moments that are gameplay but are not a shooting gallery.
This game would look so different if it had come out even, like, 5 years later. is kind of the interesting thing to me structurally.
Yeah, you blow up the facility, you earn her loyalty, but then her loyalty is immediately put back in doubt because I guess we haven't done Miranda's yet, but I'd like to cover this part.
Yeah, we'll get around to Jacob and Miranda's loyalty missions next episode, but I think this is it's relevant here, of course.
Completing both Miranda and Jack's loyalty missions prompts them to fight over Cerberus's treatment of Jack. Miranda basically tells Jack that their actions were justified because they produced such great biotic power, and that Cerberus is inculpable because they were rogue agents. This obviously upsets Jack.
Yeah, can you imagine? Yeah.
And Shepard is allowed to, by the standards of these games, occupy a slightly nuanced position. You are allowed to use either persuade or intimidate options to basically to tell them both to shut up and to simultaneously convince both of them to end the argument while keeping both of their loyalty. Or if this is your roleplay preference, you can take one of their side and then still regain the other person's loyalty back by persuading them separately later. And I will also note that specifically those second persuade prompts are easier to achieve than the original. That one has a very high ranking behind it.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
It's an accessibility option as much as it is a nice bit of narrative divergence as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice. And that's that for our third episode on Mass Effect 2. We hope you've enjoyed listening, and encourage you to come back next time for the fourth part of our Mass Effect coverage, where we didn't get around to too many loyalty missions this time, but we will be finishing them off next time. In the interim, consider backing us at patreon.com/franchisefestival, where you get access to a bonus episode each month, and have the chance to vote on future episode topics. If you have any feedback or suggestions, you can also email us at franchisefestival@gmail.com. Once again, we've been your hosts, Chris,
Spencer,
and I'm Hamilton.
Thanks for listening, folks. Goodbye.